everybody. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're speaking with Cale Jaffe, professor of law and director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia Law School. We'll talk to a transgender man as well named Charlie about his life's journey to find himself. But first, before we do that, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. Have you always been welcoming everybody like that at the top of the show? Welcome, everybody. It's very nice. I had not noticed that, if you have been.
Yes, I think we're finally getting to the point where we're so comfortable we didn't notice things before, and now we're noticing things.
I guess. And your name is?
Where do I know you?
Exactly. Hey, listen, It occurred to me that it is so strange, the world we live in now. So strange. Here is how I know that you may not even have realized this happened on Tuesday, but apparently George and Amal Clooney had twins.
I did
and
hear.
And in a different world, We would totally know that. We would know everything about their weight and where they were and et cetera.
You're so right about that.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you know?
I heard about it.
Yeah, but all right.
But it's not like I don't know any more details. We would have known, gender. We would have known sexual orientation. Right. We would have known names.
The kale puree that's organically free-traded coming in from somewhere where he was, providing water. It's nothing. It just happened. It's gone.
You know what I want to talk about? Something?
No.
Okay. Something that happened this Thursday that you don't think that you're going to be surprised about. There was a Senate hearing. However, did you know it was Seersucker Thursday in the Senate that day?
I thought it was just Sucker Thursday. Yeah. Every day is Sucker Day at the Senate. No, I did not know. Please, Ellen,
I'm thrilled you don't know, because that means a lot of people didn't know as well, but I noticed Dianne Feinstein wore a seersucker suit, and then I saw it somewhere, but it became popular to wear those suits in the hot summer days in D.C. way, way back, but then air conditioning came, and no one was wearing them anymore. Apparently, they're really easy to dry, and you can just throw them on when you have to wash them a lot. They're easy in the hot weather. But a Mississippi senator wanted to reinstate the tradition in 1996, and he designated a Seersucker Thursday in the Senate. And then Dianne Feinstein was seeing there's a lot of women in the Senate around the O's, '05. So she gave all the senators outfits as gifts in '05.
Wow.
Yeah, so in 11 of the 14 at that time, women senators wore them. So that's the history.
You know what's going to happen to this tradition, if I may?
Yes.
I predict.
What's that?
Somehow, the Trump collection will have a seersucker collection that will all be mandated to wear, next year if he's still kicking around.
I thought of a great idea. Instead of the little pinstripes, instead of the pinstripes, they could be jail stripes.
Yeah, I like it. They can turn them horizontal. Exactly.
And then just one little tidbit, because I just love etymology.
Fashion?
Yeah, and fashion. The term seersucker came from the Persian word for milk and sugar, shir oshaka.
Oh, that's going to have to change if he finds out about this. That will not. It'll have to be something, the amber wave, a horizontal, I don't know, he'll figure it out. He'll,
right.
Anyway, but that is, I'm sad that I did not know that more than the fact that George and Amal had two little ones somewhere. Anyway,
I also loved that Pelosi. Did you catch her mini speech?
In general. It sounds like I missed something in particular.
Well, that's okay. She just was talking about Trump and said, first he'll try to charm you. If that doesn't work, he'll bully, then abandon, and then sue. and that we should know your blood type. You should know your blood type if you're in D.C. because he'll throw you under the bus. And that this was the best part. She goes, he needs work and he needs sleep.
A long sleep. Yeah. I know this healthcare thing is coming up. They're sneaking it in just like they did on the House side. They're going to sneak it in while we're all talking, rightfully so, about the Russia tentacles there. I saw Senator McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, already put them all on their heels in whatever committee she's on in the Senate where they're supposed to be hearing about health care. And apparently, the GOP has no one's read it. It's the same thing as what happened last month. No one's read it. No one's seen it. Mm-hmm. There's no score on it. And it's almost ready to be voted on, and it's happening. And she had a really impassioned speech. I'm not sure if it was yesterday, but that's the day I heard it anyway, mm-hmm. about what they're doing. Once again, creating legislation that no one gets to know about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read something about that we're in the shallow state, that people just aren't reading, including, our congresspeople. Is it time for an event? Look out.
Oh, do you have one?
I have one. There's a People Summit in Chicago. So in honor of that, we're doing one in Charlottesville at the Haven today. And it is people and organizations meeting for social, racial, and economic justice. And that is here from noon to 9 p.m. at the Haven. There's going to be speakers, including Tom Perriello. He'll be there in person at 3:30, and then they're going to stream in Bernie Sanders at 8 p.m., and it's free and open to the public.
He's being streamed.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how you feel about that. We can talk about that another time.
I was just thinking, actually.
It's a good topic. And also the Virginia state primary election is on June 13th, so everybody get out and vote. Primaries for governor, lieutenant governor, House of Delegates, and other local offices.
Okay.
So we have an amazing show today, and let's get right to that. Our first guest is Cale Jaffe, assistant professor of law and director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law. Welcome, Cale.
Thank you all very much for having me on the radio.
Yes, it's a pleasure. So I wanted to get right to the Paris Agreement. Given the U.S. withdrawal, and you've written a lot about it. I'll let you do the talking. Can you outline first what it is for us just briefly, and then we can get into your views about it?
Well, so the Paris Agreement, as I think most of your listeners are aware, was a landmark achievement many, many years in the making that brought together the overwhelming majority of the countries across the planet to commit to a plan to reduce carbon dioxide pollution, a critical component of human-induced climate change, and set us on a path to essentially avoid the most dangerous levels of emissions or the most dangerous levels of increased temperature rise. So, for example, the 2% goal that folks have heard maybe a lot about, sort of trying to keep warming below that 2% level, what's often been referred to as the guardrail. The reason why that's so important is at a certain point, the warming gets enough that the land-based ice sheets, polar ice sheets and Antarctic ice sheets begin to melt and move into the oceans. And then at that point, you've started a process that is essentially impossible to unwind.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just curious why, because I know it's a lie, why is Trump saying that getting out of the Paris Agreement is better for our economy and our jobs? How much is that in the wrong?
It ignores a lot of vital facts that are frankly right at his fingertips if he were to look at them. Solar jobs right now, today in the United States, are well more than double the number of coal-related jobs in the United States. The wind industry, already over 100,000 jobs, much smaller than solar at this point, but still a significant player, and grew by more than 30% last year. So it's not a question of jobs versus the environment. Because frankly, the renewable energy industry, the new energy economy, as it's often referred to, is growing like gangbusters. And we have an opportunity to either lead on that or defer that leadership to other nations.
Because, you know, that is the, I have a bellwether person I talk to about what, you know, what are your views? I ask him, and that's how I know what Fox is saying. So that was the first thing out of his mouth. The coal miners, the coal jobs. So once again, just digging a little deeper, you get the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
But I learned that the businesses don't, even though he is pulling out of the agreement, American businesses do not have to do that. They can continue to honor that, the percentage that you mentioned, and any other green initiatives they want, right? They can act independently of him. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I've been talking to folks about it and to my kids about it, is saying, you know, actually, we can say that this is President Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement is in some ways better, this is the optimist in me speaking, than President Trump staying in the agreement. Because if he stays in the agreement, we know he isn't going to do anything on it. We know he's still going to undercut solar, wind, and renewable energy industry, and he's not going to move. He's going to repeal President Obama's Clean Power Plan. So we know he's not going to actually do anything to reduce global warming pollution. But he's not going to. But the rest of the world is going to think, oh, the United States is still in the agreement. By pulling out, he sends a very clear signal to the rest of the world that the United States is not going to lead on this. You need to pick up the ball, and we're seeing that already. He announced his withdrawal from the Paris Agreement on a Thursday, and the next Friday, the leaders of the EU and China had a joint statement saying, we're sticking to our agreement, we're going to take the lead on this. And frankly, that's the response that we'd hoped for, that the rest of the world would see Trump's action as a call to arms. And we're seeing that same call to arms within the country, with states stepping up to lead, with local governments, city councils stepping up to lead, and private citizens.
Right. And to add to the group, France, Macron invited Americans to move to France in order to research climate change. And that was amazing. He has a website, Make Our Planet Great Again.
Yeah, Emmanuel Macron has been definitely trolling Donald Trump on, and his Facebook videos have been going viral, sort of on things exactly like that, that make the planet great again.
And I read that Mayor Michael Bloomberg is going to pledge $15 million to the UN or pay the dues the U.S. Would be paying. Does that? Since the U.S. government will not, apparently, will that help? Will that as much?
I think that sends an important signal. It's obviously real money, so it's more than just symbolic. But when the need in terms of a global commitment is in this billions and billions of dollars with a B, $15 million contribution is not making up for the damage that President Trump has caused by his withdrawal from the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, it is quite incredible, especially I was wondering your opinion of, you know, the idea of ignoring climate change as a threat, since he's all about this, as a threat to national security, how ignoring the climate change does that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And one thing I think that the environmental community really has an opportunity to do here is reach out to the group that were the so-called Never Trump Republicans, the folks who were big on national security issues, big on global trade agreements. Those folks really have no home right now. There was a Department of Defense report to Congress, I think it was in 2015, that labeled climate change and I think the phrase was an imminent national security threat, and it talked in very sobering terms about the need for the U.S. to lead on reducing carbon pollution, because this was going to be driving national security issues for decades to come.
Do you have any specifics on that? Do you happen to know where places we can go? I mean, that's just really fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's still easily findable via everybody's favorite friend, Google. Mm-hmm. If you Googled Department of Defense, climate, national security, I imagine it would come up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, taking some of the politics out of this climate change policy, I know you have some opinions on how environmentalists and conservatives can actually work together, even though Trump, you know, obviously refuses not to. So I was just wondering if you could share some of your philosophy on that.
Sure. Well, one thing that has been really radical about President Trump's environmental policy so far is he has adopted what I would refer to as essentially a costs-only approach. You know, the traditional conservative approach to regulation is to say, well, we need to do a cost-benefit analysis of any issue that we're going to regulate. We look at the benefits quantified in real dollars and compare that to the costs imposed on the regulated industry for providing those benefits. So, you know, you look at reduction in asthma rates and lung cancer rates and COPD, those kinds of things, from reducing air pollution from coal-fired power plants, and then you look at the cost of achieving those reductions. The Trump administration really has thrown out the benefits analysis. If you look at the formative documents that have come out, executive orders and things like that, all they've talked about is the cost to industry. And it really is anathema to the way that traditional conservatives have looked at environmental issues for decades.
Do you think it's just, is it your opinion? Well, what's your opinion, the reason he's doing this?
Yeah, the reason I think he's doing it is what, you know, there's this problem that law students learn about called agency capture, where essentially the regulators get too cozy with the industry they're supposed to be regulating. And the Trump folks have taken the problem of agency capture and embraced it as a positive good. And so they are, you know, the arguments that you would see from the coal industry lobbyists, from the oil and gas industry lobbyists, those are the arguments that the Trump administration is making. There is there's a Koch Industries funded group called Freedom Partners that published a pamphlet called A Roadmap to Repeal, about basically how to repeal all these environmental regulations. Mm-hmm. And that is reading like the Trump administration's playbook. The roadmap to repeal that the Koch Industries group has drafted is the exact roadmap that the Trump administration is following.
But, you know, one thing I don't, well, there's many things I don't understand, but about this, I know that when a business takes on a environment, or used to, takes on an environmental stance, they get like a tax credit. They'll get benefits like that, and that spurs on job creation because they're getting tax incentives, is the word I'm thinking of. So why doesn't that appeal to more conservatives to be environmentally, you know, favorable?
You know, again, I think this is where there is an opportunity where the Trump administration's approach is really a very radical approach, and that traditional conservatives don't have a home there. You look at, again, it really comes back to this sort of cost-benefit analysis. There is a lot of, I mean, even if you look back at the Reagan administration in the 80s, where obviously they were famous for a very anti-regulatory approach and a deregulatory approach. Nonetheless, the documents that they put out still talked about needing to recognize the benefits, the public health benefits, the environmental benefits. You know, the EPA's founding administrator, a guy named William Ruckelshaus, in the Nixon administration, talked about the need to, you know, this public service need to clean air, clean water, that was their founding mission. And that has just been completely lost with the current administration.
We're talking with Cale Jaffe, law professor at UVA, director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic there. Also, we'll be speaking with Charlie a little bit later about his journey and becoming a trans man. We'll be back with Cale in a minute. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you're listening to Apropos of Something. We are speaking with law professor and director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at UVA, Cale Jaffe.
And Cale, actually, when we left for the commercial break, you were just mentioning the EPA, and that is the perfect entree for me to ask you, what is the purpose? As maybe in the past tense, but what is the purpose of the EPA and what is its scope?
Well, that's a great question. The EPA was created in 1970 to really be the lead executive agency on public health and environmental issues, broad scale, to organize a comprehensive approach to ensuring that we had clean air, clean water, that the special places throughout the country were protected. So, you know, you look at the sort of the purpose statements in these sort of founding acts, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. You know, the Clean Air Act talks about a mission to protect and enhance the quality of the nation's air resources to promote public health and welfare. Clean Water Act has similar language. So that's really, you know, we talk a lot about sort of jobs and renewable energy jobs and the clean energy economy and impacts on coal jobs and the older energy economy. And those are obviously important factors, but the founding mission, the reason we have an EPA, is these public health and environmental goals. And, you know, if I can keep going on this, because there's one thing that the Trump administration, Administrator Pruitt, who's the leader of the EPA, said that really unsettled me. In his first speech to the EPA staff, just after he was confirmed by the Senate, he said, "Regulators exist to give certainty to those that they regulate." And he went on and talked about coordinating with the permit applicants. He said, "That's the job of the regulator." And he focused all on this sort of customer service approach to the polluting industries. And my thought was, that's not the reason you exist. That's not the purpose that EPA exists. That might be an important factor in how you run the agency. It might be a means for achieving your goals. But your goals have to be clean air, clean water, protection of endangered species, those sort of special public values that adhere to all of us. And Administrator Pruitt's opening statement didn't mention any of those environmental goals. It didn't emphasize any of those issues about clean air and clean water. It just talked about customer service to the regulated industry.
Yeah, what is his background? I know it's not good. What is it?
So he really, you know, Administrator Pruitt really rose to national prominence during the Obama administration. He was the Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma and really made a name for himself by bringing a series of lawsuits. I want to say it was 13, though it's somewhere around that, you know, suing the Obama administration over carbon dioxide pollution rules that the administration was pushing, the Clean Power Plan, suing over mercury rules that the administration was putting into place, rules, by the way, that were required in many cases by the congressional language that is in the Clean Air Act. And so that's what really put him at the top of the heap from a Trump administration perspective in terms of looking for folks to bring in to run EPA. So you're bringing in someone to run the EPA who made his name by trying to dismantle what the EPA was doing.
Again, it's just a part of the plan, it seems like, pulling the wool over people's eyes that this is really good for us when, in fact, everything is just made to deconstruct these agencies, from Betsy DeVos to this, just, I don't know, it's startling to me.
Yeah, what, and in that, I know you mentioned it earlier, Cale, that Trump's executive order regarding the EPA, how bad is it? You know, how much does he want to dismantle?
Well, he's done two executive orders that really directly impact the EPA, but the one that's gotten the most attention is what's called his two-for-one order, which essentially what he said explicitly in this executive order is, for any one regulation that EPA or other federal agency wants to promulgate, they have to identify two other regulations that they would propose to eliminate. It's a completely nonsensical approach to government regulation, and in fact, it's a series of groups, Public Citizen and NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, have already filed a lawsuit challenging the rule as arbitrary and capricious. Or the executive order is arbitrary and capricious. The basic idea is this idea that as if, you know, regulations were sort of like, you know, cans of beans at the grocery store and you can have a 2-for-1 sale on it. It just makes no sense at all to how the acts are structured, what a regulation actually is, and what's required to, again, to serve out that or to carry out that public service mission of clean air, clean water, protection of endangered species.
And this was the, now that, you know, there were two, this was the executive order, I believe, or you're going to tell me, is the one that you and 84 of your colleagues wrote about explaining the dangers of this in particular. Is that correct? Is that the one?
They're closely linked. The follow-up, it was the second executive order that built on the 2-for-1 order that then triggered an EPA notice and comment period to basically say, where EPA said, we are asking the public for recommendations on what regulations we might repeal. They didn't talk at all about, they didn't seek any comment on how regulations are working well for you or how regulations have reduced asthma rates in Atlanta or how regulations have helped bring the Chesapeake Bay back to some semblance of health. None of the benefits were asked for. It was just, what can we cut? And it's really a shockingly broad scale request for comment to say, we want to look back at 40 years of environmental safeguards, and everything is potentially on the chopping block. That's essentially what the notice for comment, request for comment said. And so I was part of a group along with Stephanie Tai at the University of Wisconsin, and there were a total of 85 of us in environmental and administrative law professors who sent a letter to the administration through that notice and comment process to say, wait a minute, you are forgetting the foundational purposes for these statutes that you were charged with carrying out.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like the health aspect of this is so obvious, you know, let alone the new businesses that will come from renewable energy is just and I don't know the numbers, but, you know, the money that will be spent on health issues and asthma and heart disease, et cetera. And I'm so saddened by, but I was wondering if you know more those details that I do not about the dangers of abandoning this.
Sure. Well, just on the economic standpoint and the numbers you talk about, I mean, these are numbers from the federal government. The U.S. Department of Energy has the data that says in 2016, last year, solar-rated jobs were 373,000 jobs in the country, 373,000 in the solar-related fields. Coal-related jobs were 160,000. So, you know, less than half as many coal jobs as solar jobs already. The solar industry is growing by leaps and bounds. The wind industry is growing by leaps and bounds. There are real economic opportunities here in a clean energy economy.
We're speaking with Cale Jaffe, UVA law professor. We're talking about the EPA right now. What would you suggest as we come to a close with this interview? What people can do, citizens, people like you and me.
You know, that's a great question. One is you can get involved in these regulatory processes, and you can help make them front page news. You know, there are notice and comment deadlines anytime the administration or any presidential administration goes to do something for good or for ill. Often there is a notice and comment regulatory process. So not just writing physical comments, but they'll have public hearings. And those public hearings get press coverage. You know, if they do a public hearing up in Arlington, Virginia, on a regulatory repeal initiative, and the place is packed with protesters, you know, that gets attention. So keep an eye on websites like regulations.gov so that you know what this administration is doing.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you all for the opportunity.
I don't want to know what they're doing anymore.
I know.
I want them gone.
But I like the positive spin you put on it, that it's really bringing this to our attention. Now we know what's going on, and we can't wait for someone else to do it first, basically.
It's been a call to arms, and it's been great to see so many states, Virginia included, that have stepped up to say, we are going to carry out our obligations under the Paris Accord, whether the United States federal government leads or not.
Mm-hmm. Thank
Such
you.
A good point.
Thanks.
Thanks, Cale Jaffe. Yep. So, Nancy.
Yes, let me guess. You want to hear about seersucker news of note?
Yes.
I don't have any that are fabric related, but I do have, unfortunately, a Trump related news of note, and it is this. Since 2011, he's been skimming hundreds and thousands of dollars from his son Eric's charity events for kids' cancer research and funneling it all back to the Trump organization. More than $500,000 he has redonated to other charities, many of which are connected to the Trump family members of, Trump family members' interests. And his, to sum it up, since I know I can't go on forever about this, but he said, you know, I don't care if it's my son or not, everybody gets billed. Your president. I know he's not your president, but you know. It's, your turn. What do you got?
It's horrible.
Yeah. Good time.
Okay. I don't have anything right now. No. I wanted to say it's Gay Pride Month all over the country. In June, and there's a DC parade tomorrow, in fact, and there's, check your websites, there's stuff going on all over the place, and that unfortunately Trump took this as a message that he needed to speak to a Road to Majority conference, which is evangelical extremists gathering in a place hosted by homophobic Faith and Freedom Coalition, the Faith and Freedom Coalition. So it just, I don't know, mind-boggling once again, because he did say he was in support of LGBTQ, but we know otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Because who are you going to believe? A 40-year in the, you know, prosecutor, or this guy who runs a, who just paid $25 million for a fraud settlement that, you know. I know, I'm diverting over to Comey versus Trump, but to your point that he's going to be friendly to the LGBTQ community, who's buying it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Well, with that, I would like to introduce our next guest, Charlie. He's a trans man here to talk about his story. I'm leaving his last name out, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. That was his preference. So, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Ellen, for having me.
Hey. To see you, sort of.
Yeah. It's great to see you and have you here. So can you tell us what the word trans means is someone whose gender identity doesn't necessarily match the sex assigned to them when they were born. Is that your definition?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of knew something was wrong as early as 6 or 7 years old. You know, I had a struggle with my parents. I hated wearing dresses. I hated the whole nine yards of being a girl. But, of course, back in the 60s, you know, what did I know? So I struggled with this for all my life. Mm-hmm. And I just transitioned about 8 years ago. So, yes, I was not in the right body.
And when and how did you know that you wanted to change your sexual identity?
Well, it got to a breaking point. About 8 years ago, it was going to be either something had to happen or I was literally going to blow my brains out. I was to that point. Extremely depressed, couldn't hold a relationship down, angry all the time. I went into therapy. And basically through therapy, I just worked for about a year before I actually transitioned or put any testosterone or hormone treatment therapy. And I worked for a year with a therapist. And finally, one night, I was just writing because I was up late. And I was still, even with working with this therapist, extremely miserable. I didn't fit in. I just didn't fit in working. I didn't fit in. I felt like I didn't fit in with family. I didn't fit in with friends. I didn't fit in with this group or that group. I tried to be the butch lesbian. Couldn't do it. Extremely depressed, extremely unhappy. And I just started writing one night, and the words, I am transgender, came out on the page. And so I basically took my journal in to my therapist and said, I can't speak it because I don't know it, but can you read this? Can you take this home and read it? And from there, we just started doing a lot of research. I lived for about a year without any hormone therapy, changed my name in about 14 months into doing this. And it's been this has been my path ever since.
And how did you feel once that happened, once you made that decision?
It was probably one of the most freeing experiences I've ever had. You know, I was thinking on the drive here, I've had three do-overs in life. People don't really have that. When I was, before I transitioned and years before that, I was about 500 pounds, depressed, drinking, drugging. I went into treatment. I all applause to the recovery of AA because it saved my life that time. The surgery saved my life the second time. And the third time was when I admitted that I am a man. And that's been my three do-overs. I might have some more, I hope, maybe.
Yeah. It's fascinating. We're talking to Charlie. He's talking about his journey to becoming a trans man. We'll be back with more with Charlie after this. Welcome back to the program. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I wanted to remind everyone, if you think someone might benefit from this broadcast or any other broadcast that we've done, you can go to the WPVC website. That's 947WPVC.org. Look for Apropos of Something, and we have all of our shows there. And they are, I have to say, Nancy, we've done a pretty good job collecting really interesting people. I mean, just to put it back on them, I mean, I think we've had some really cool guests.
I know. They have elevated our game, no question.
For sure.
Today is another one, for sure.
Definitely. I'm really enjoying talking to Charlie here, talking about his journey, becoming a trans man.
Yeah, Charlie, you had mentioned early on that you were aware that you were uncomfortable in your skin. Those were not your words, but that you were aware that you weren't, something wasn't right. And I was just wondering how long before you shared anything with your family about that?
With my family, it was a while. I shared with friends, and I actually shared with my fellowship of people in Alcoholics Anonymous first. And I did that by telling my story and telling people where my journey was going to lead, and it was with open arms. My family, we're a close family, we're close-knit. But they have their challenges with trying to accept what it is, and it's not so much that they don't want to. It's just 50 years they knew me as Charlotte, and they knew that I was a female. And they had to go through the acceptance. You know, this is a typical African American, Bible based, raised Southern family. So you know, what the Bible says to them is what it says, and so they had to accept me being gay first, and I wasn't even accepting that I was gay, but that was the only label that I knew to tell them that I was. And then, you know, thus, it's been a hard pill for them to swallow, but one of the great things is my older sister now gives me birthday cards that say, happy birthday, brother. I like that. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? Which part of growing up was the toughest, or was it all tough?
It wasn't all tough. I pretty much liked playing alone with my GI. I was allowed to have GI Joes and the little green plastic army men. I still have a couple of those. I love those. Yeah. But I think the toughest part, really, this sounds really crazy, was putting on a dress and having to, you know, get my hair fancied up. I remember looking so miserable in the pictures of my sister's wedding. I was one of the junior bridesmaids, and so had a cousin that was just loving it because she could wear the purse and get all frilly and so forth. And then there's me, and I'm literally hiding under the table at the reception because I don't want to come out anymore. I just want to hide and, you know, put the shorts and the baseball cap on. So I think it was the whole thing of being like a little girl.
What helped you along the way? Were there significant people other than your family?
I had friends that was helping me along the way. My journey into transition, because amazingly enough, that was almost 8 years ago. In 8 years, I had to drive to Richmond to get my hormone therapy because it wasn't offered here in Charlottesville. So I had to find outside help and kind of put in a plug in. one of the groups that helped me was a friend of mine found a Black Trans Men Incorporated, and they are located in Dallas, Texas. And I found them on Facebook. And these guys literally took me under their wing and taught me, you know, you need to buy this kind of binder. You need to do this. You need to do that. You do this with injecting the shot on your own. So it was like cyberspace friends, these people that I've never physically seen, but they're like my brothers. And so this is Black Trans Men Incorporated. Their corporate office is in Dallas, Texas. I am now one of the state chapter leaders for Virginia. And they, you can look them up on blacktrans.org. Great resource for anybody looking. They also service the trans, Black trans women as well.
That's fantastic.
What was your health coverage like, you know, for this transition?
Well, I can kind of segue into that as to why I'm not using my last name today. Basically, I was at a Pride event and was interviewed by the local newspaper and used my last name. Within 3 days, I was out of a job. So I'm almost convinced that this company, I know this company got rid of me, because when I walked into the break room that Tuesday morning after the Saturday event, the newspaper from Sunday was face up on the break room table.
Oh, God, you're kidding.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Did you do anything as a result of that?
No. I mean, it was right at that time where there was not much to do. I didn't have a lot of evidence to prove. And it was one of those tuck, tail, and run. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sitting here, I'm thinking, okay, you know, if I'm ever going to take that step, if I'm ever going to get out of the boat, my last name is Burton. You know, I'm just going to say it here. I mean, and that's to help someone else, and so also help me as well.
Thank you. In
terms of the work places you've been employed, what kind of discrimination have you faced?
I haven't. You know, amazingly enough, here in Charlottesville, I had a harder time getting a job as a butch lesbian. I stayed unemployed more as a butch lesbian, because you would walk into this interview and you could see the, oh my God, what is this look? You know, because my friends say I didn't have to do much to transition. So, you know, here I am sitting across this table and I've got female on my application, and you've got these guys sitting here looking like, I'm not sure. And of course, I never got the job. Once I transitioned, amazingly enough, as a Black male, I've had absolutely no problems finding a job at all. As a matter of fact, I've got a great job now. The health benefits suck, of course, but
that's normal. You're
that's
in.
Normal living. That's right. That's right.
Among the rest of us.
That's
now.
Right.
So
yeah.
did it change it if and when people learned that you were transgender?
Basically, with my jobs, HR knows, and they don't skip a beat. They're just like, okay, you're fine. You know, you qualify for the job. Mm-hmm. This is something that we don't need to disclose unless you want to disclose it to other people. And so I've not had a problem at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Good news.
And what kind of time is involved, you know, month-wise or whatever, what kind of time is involved for the surgery, the medical procedures that you have had?
The only procedures that I've had thus far, because I'm trying to raise the money to have what is top surgery, and that's somewhere around $10,000. I had went to a doctor, submitted it to my insurance. They had denied it. That was about 4 months ago, and amazingly enough, there's a disorder called gender dysphoria. And for me, this gender dysphoria is, you know, I'm kind of real conscious of how I look and how I present myself. I am I'll suffer from gender dysphoria if I think my shirt doesn't fit right, and so you're looking at this bulge because I haven't had the top surgery. And when I was denied the surgery with my insurance, it put me in a spiral. It put me down in a kind of a deep depression. And, you know, once again, I have learned from my recovery what I need to do is take action. And so I basically took action, not willingly enough as I should have been, but take action with going to get some more help. I have now put in an appeal for the surgery. So basically what I have right now is I take testosterone. And I go see an endocrinologist about once every 6 months for levels. Now, that can be tricky because back about 4 months ago, my levels were sky high. It needs to stay somewhere in the range of mine, about 800-900. I was at 14, and I was very short-tempered, had some little anger issues. And now that the levels are back down, I'm back to being calm and being able to handle things a lot better.
What kind of activism? You mentioned you were the chapter president.
State chapter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. State chapter.
What are you doing in that role?
Basically, I'm mentoring a lot of the younger guys, and it's still basically through social media. So my name is out there. If someone in Virginia is, for an example, a young man contacted me about a month ago. He had lost his job. He was trying to find a job, and his problem was he didn't have the money to be able to do the marker change. So he didn't have the money to be able to go to DMV, to the courts, and get his name changed and his gender changed on his ID. He was struggling to try to find a job. So we kind of gathered as a group, the black trans men, and we have resources all throughout the state, and was able to at least get him some housing. And he did go back and fight with his current job. He did not win the appeal. He was pretty convinced that he too got fired because of them discovering they started questioning his gender with his marker. At this point, he doesn't have a job, but at least he has a roof over his head. These are the kind of things that we do at the Black Trans Men Incorporated. I'm also on the board, if I can plug in a little bit, of the Transgender Health Alliance of Central Virginia. That's FACFA here in Charlottesville, and it works to ensure affordable and respectable comprehensive health care for every member of the transgender community through education, advocacy, and outreach. And another board that I'm on is the PFLAG. And so PFLAG is basically the PFLAG of Blue Ridge. It's made up of parents, families, friends, and allies, uniting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered loved ones to promote support and help. In Charlottesville, they have a support group. The PFLAG support group, is the third Saturday of every month, and you can check the website for details, and that is pflagblueridge.org.
And I'm gonna put all these resources on our webpage,
right.
Just
great.
To help people.
Great.
Yeah, and
great.
I discovered another PFLAG website when I was doing a little bit of research called straightforequality.org, which focuses on LGBTQ. So gay, lesbian, not only trans, and including trans, and I found it very helpful. There's some guides there you have to dig a little to find that I thought were really great, and that was PFLAG. So PFLAG I've known for a really long time, very supportive.
Absolutely.
In terms of, you know, families who get to the point, if they need to, I use the word transition, but to transition from resistance to then acceptance and then embracing, it's a great organization to be connected with.
The Trans Health Alliance is very powerful because they gather a lot of the physicians and therapists to be there for. It gears a lot towards the young and the adolescents, but they also help people, old guys like me. They are a strong group here in Central Virginia right now.
I know that time is running out, but I do want to ask you, Charlie, how are you feeling about your life now?
My life is great. My life is fantastic. I am a proud man to be able to step out every day and just literally be who I am. It has been a struggle. I have been a victim, but now I'm a victor of everything that I have done. I am finally comfortable. I am a man comfortable underneath the skin that was of a female. I am definitely comfortable who I am, even here in Charlottesville.
That is inspiring. Thank you
so
much, Charlie.
Well,
thanks for being here.
You deserve nothing less. My goodness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
Oh, thank you both.
So, again, we'll put the resources on the WPVC website. That's 947-WPVC.org. And we may tweet about them as well at AOS Radio. Nancy?
Yeah. No, I thought you were going to thank our guests.
Sorry. Thank you again, Cale Jaffe and Charlie Burton.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say that we're also thankful to Keller Williams, who sponsors our program, and
a palate cleanser.
A palate cleanser.
Okay, I got one. Instead of puppies, which is where I really was after this week, I'm close. I learned that the most popular breed of dog in America is a Labrador Retriever, and the least popular is the American Foxhound. And apparently the Labrador Retriever is most popular, well, one of the reasons. I mean, I know they're adorable, but they play well with others as opposed to the American Foxhound, which is kind of stubborn, apparently. So as people, we should take a lesson once again from our dogs. This is how we should choose our presidents. We should choose one that plays well with others. And right now we have chosen very poorly. Yes. Anyway, what do you got? Sorry.
I think I've used all mine up for now. No more palate cleansers. I'll just refer back to Seersucker and say that also was a way that Democrats and Republicans could have some humor, and I'd love to harken back to those days when people can get along with each other.
Yes, when it was country first.
Yes, country first. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So on that note, we look forward to next week. We'll have some more amazing guests that will be apropos of something, to be sure. So thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Ellen.
And we'll talk to you
soon. Good day.
Yeah. See you, Nance.